You're listening to Within Tolerance, a podcast for machinists by a machinist. I'm your host, Dylan Jackson of Protean Machining, and this week I'm happy to welcome Jamie Underwood. Welcome, Jamie.
Hey, Dylan. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. This is pretty exciting. Been listening to your podcast for some time, and you know, always find it very informative, so hopefully I can return the favor. So.
Definitely. So for those who don't know you, who are you and what do you do?
Well, currently I'm the head of programming at Hadrian Automation, a longtime journeyman machinist, manufacturing engineer. I've worked at various tech companies, currently building out our second factory at Hadrian, rounding out kind of the initial CAM programming team. And, you know, trying to figure out how to scale this business, which is incredibly challenging, but quite fun.
So for those who haven't heard of Hadrian, what is Hadrian's mission and what do you guys do or what do you specialize in?
Well, Hadrian's mission at like the macro level is to shore up the supply chain within the country, particularly focused on aerospace and defense component level manufacturing, likely branches out later on, but that's the overall mission right now for the company. For my internal mission, and kind of one of Hadrian's major hurdles over the next half a decade is to reinvigorate a source of employee. So basically trade schools, non-traditional arenas, like bringing construction workers into the trade, into machining. And that's, you know, what excites me is trying to train the next generation of machinists.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting problem because I think, you know, altruistically, we all want more people in the trade and we want more people to enjoy it because we love it so much. But also selfishly, like, I mean, I run a business. I don't know who I'm going to hire. Like, there's not that many people out there that I would either A, want to hire, or B, that there is even people out there to be hire. So I totally understand that.
Yeah, it's the thing that keeps me up at night. It feels like... It feels like there's a finite, you know, resource pool, and it definitely, the deeper and deeper I get into the problem that is like scaling Hadrian, the more I realize how much work is ahead of, you know, myself and an entire industry if we actually want to get back to like appropriate levels of manufacturing employment.
Definitely. Well, let's get into how you got into the trade. So what is your backstory and how did you end up at Hadrian?
All right. Well, I'll rewind back to high school. Selfishly wanted to get out of class. So I started to take as many shop classes as I could take, which was like at a community college. It was outside of the high school itself. So it was awesome. I got to leave school half my junior and senior year. I got to leave school like a half day and then go to shop class, which gave me direct credits to go into a machining trade, either it was like welding or machining at the time, I think. Senior year, was thinking about going to college, what I wanted to do next. And I remember like it was yesterday, my counselor asked me to not go into manufacturing. She was nice about it, but basically at that time, this was the late 90s. I grew up in the Rust Belt up out of Chicago. A lot of people had lost their jobs to globalization. My hometown had lost like roughly 70% of its manufacturing output in that decade. And it was just a scary prospect to like go into that trade. And I entertained that for a while. I decided I wasn't going to go into the trade, partly because my entire family was in the trade or was a part of manufacturing at the time or had been. And like, you know, I was a little bit of a rebel, didn't want to go into doing like what my dad had done or, you know, family members. So I worked at a printing press, creating the actual content that would go on a roller and then get transmitted to paper. And I didn't really care for it all that much. And it was kind of related to manufacturing. So I was trying to push away from that. Until one day the press went down and the press operator actually knew my dad was a millwright and decided that I would be able to fix the roller, which I didn't have any idea what I was doing. They handed me like an 80-pound roller, showed me down to this really dingy tool room they had in the basement of the factory, and said, you know, figure it out. And, you know, a couple burn marks later from the welder and a couple really loud screeching grinding noises from the manual lathe, me trying to figure out the gear ratio I needed, I came up with a shiny new roller, and they plopped it into the press, and it enabled, you know, 7 or 8 people to get back to work. And I remember the feeling of being able to fix a problem that was bigger than myself, right? It was like other people, now their day was affected by something that I was able to give to them and help them with. And I just remember never wanting to go into it, never wanted to go anywhere further than, you know, the 100 feet away from the shop ever again. So I was then able to talk to a few of my friends that were in the trade and get myself a job at a company called Valley Jig Grinding, which was in Rockford, Illinois. A friend of mine, Eric, actually got me in. My title was apprentice machinist. And it really was kind of more, I was the janitor, like clean the bathrooms, organize the stock rack, and in exchange to get a few hours of manual Bridgeport time at the end of the day, which was awesome. But also it was something that even at that time, I didn't know any better, but it felt like there was a quicker way to get to the CNCs, which was my actual goal. My boss started to notice that I would go at night and start like manually editing G code on like a Haas machine, which was our first real CNC machine. And noticed that, you know, some of the stuff I was doing on there was actually working for the factory or for the shop. Saw something in me, even though he was mad that I was jumping on machinery I wasn't supposed to be on, and sent me to journeyman school. I spent 4 years in that kind of course, went through all the metrology stuff, went through all the GD&T, just all the things that are journeyman school, you know, at night. Really, really enjoyed it, started to excel at it, and then eventually graduated with my manufacturing engineering degree. And then started on my journey to like what I thought was like the mecca of manufacturing, which is going and working on a factory floor and really going through the high production volume stuff. Really didn't enjoy it. It started to get to the point where like all I was doing was trying to take, you know, milliseconds off of a program. And, you know, I started to get a little bored. And then luckily, you know, had the opportunity later on to then join a startup. It was called Tesla Motors. And it was actually quite small at the time. I forget, it was like maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people. And I believe now it's, God, I don't even want to guess. I think,
It's 20 times that or something.
Yeah, it's something ridiculous. I worked there for 2 years. I thought I was a good machinist when I started at Tesla and realized that I had a lot to learn. And I really feel like that place is really what kind of gave me the thrill of teaching other people. I worked there for a couple of years, that it probably wasn't good for my family, and had a friend that had just left Tesla to go over to Facebook and start their first labs. And that's actually where I met Rob Lockwood and, you know, myself, a few of the people that transplanted from Tesla, and Rob started building out some of the first labs at Facebook. And that kind of brought me to an aerospace lab for the last build. It was like maybe the third or fourth lab that I had worked on within Facebook, which was the Facebook Connectivity Lab, and it was located in northern Los Angeles County. I worked there for a couple of years building out a lab, and then I think it's public now, a partner of Facebook Connectivity, Amazon, bought the contingent or that technology from Facebook. I worked at Amazon for a year after that acquisition went down, kind of rebuilding the team. Usually acquisitions mean that there's some loss of rebase. So I helped rebuild that team. And then while doing that, got hooked up with Chris Power, who was definitely speaking the language of a lot of the people that I respect in industry, which is kind of the reinvigoration of of the industry within the country, and then using automation as the conduit to do that. And now I'm here 8 months into my tenure at Hadrian, and loving every minute.
Because automation had been kind of a focus of yours for quite some time. You just hadn't had the backing.
Yeah, it was something that I was trying to do for a long time. So Facebook, between a few people I was working with in the Area 404 lab, and then also in Facebook connectivity, we were really trying to focus on automating 0 to 1. I think a lot of the industry has done Industry 4.0 well, but it's usually only in the production arena. So one part, one machine, for years at a time, or either that or a family of parts, right? With like a bolt circle that changes or something. So I really wanted to do first intake of a brand new manufacturing process and how to automate that to specification, which is something that I felt like all the tools were there. The industry had all the technology that we needed to do it. It was just, I was missing the software support and I didn't have the ability to do it. And Hadrian was offering that, and it was really exciting to me to actually kind of see that through. And that's what I've been working on for since February. So.
Yeah, that's killer. I mean, I was lucky enough to visit you guys a couple of weeks back, and what you guys are building is pretty amazing. It's really, really cool to see.
Appreciate that. Yeah. What did you like about it the most? I'm curious.
It's kind of tough to pick and choose. Like, it's just it's so cool to see something built ground up to tackle a problem like that. Like, it's very often something that comes up in shops, but that they've already been started. They've already had processes that are in place that make it hard to kind of pursue that kind of automation. And so seeing something that, has that from day one in its mindset is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really one of the things I respect is the first hire at Hadrian was a machinist, which a lot of automated manufacturing companies that have came and went had started the other way, which is like hiring, 30 software engineers and then backfill with a machinist to kind of capture that knowledge. And I think Hadrian's mantra from day one is to, one, respect a machinist as much as the software engineer. There really isn't a hierarchy at the company. The company is very level when it comes to like your discipline, no matter if you're a technician on the floor or if you're a, principal software engineer working on some of the hardest problems at the company. You are recognized in the same breath and having the same value as anyone else. And that really has created a culture here where, machinists can come from any background and succeed. Last week, I had a really insane week. I worked roughly 8 hours probably, running down a problem with a machinist that has only been in the industry for 6 months. And his previous job was he was the manager of a restaurant, and now he's running Grove 550s successfully, and he's doing quite well. And so that's a small microcosm of what it's like to work here. It's, welcoming very non-traditional people into the industry, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that's another thing that you shared with me that I thought was incredibly cool is having people that, were line cooks or restaurant managers or people very atypical in the trade that are running top of the line machinery. Like, it's not like you guys are like, oh, we're going to stick you on the Haas in the corner. It's like, no, you get to learn top of the line 5X machines. Have fun.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to, even if we wanted to, right? I think, I don't know. We either have the Hermoy C42s, or the Grove 550s to choose from. I don't know which one you would consider to be, less advanced. I will say the Grove 550 for me is kinematically challenging. It frightens me. One of the things I'm very surprised by is because of the lack of experience from some of our newer machinists, they're actually less fearful than some of the more experienced folks. So when they get on the machine, they don't have the block, that block that maybe a person that knows what they're looking at initially would have. So they're actually sometimes more successful initially when they're learning that equipment, because one, they have fresh eyes, two, they do not have a historical mindset that they need to reconfigure, right? Like everything's new. So
yeah, that's pretty excellent. Well, we started talking about your team and we got a lot of questions about team building in general. So Phil, Kintz Precision, Tux Garage, they all asked about team building. I thought Phil kind of summed it up very well of, you've led some of the most talented people in the industry. What's your playbook for building high-performing collaborative teams?
All right. Well, let me try to tackle that. There's a lot. I'm reading some of these now. There's no playbook. I think the playbook, if I had to distill what the playbook would look like, it really is creating a atmosphere within your company that one has a say, everyone's opinions valued, being okay to fail, making sure that your leadership, i.e. me, does not hide their failures, but embraces them. And then the second part of that is sharing how you fixed that issue. So one of the things I think that I have seen traditionally in the industry is everyone fails when they're making a part, they scrap something. In a CAM session, they do something incorrect. But one of the things that I think has always been a lacking part of the industry is that feedback loop. So actually denoting what happens and then talking about how they fixed it and doing that in a way that, you know, they don't feel judged actually opens up a lot of opportunity for other people to learn from one another and then not repeat other people's mistakes, right? So even if you haven't made that mistake, if somebody around you that you respect admits to that mistake and then actually shares how they fixed it, usually that goes a long way to kind of other people learning in proxy of your mistakes. So
doesn't have to learn firsthand. Like, I know there's, you know, a lot of people seem to want to, but like, you know, I would much rather watch a video of somebody crashing a machine and them explain what they did wrong and not make that mistake myself. Because, I mean, I know that those are stronger lessons, but some of them are also very expensive lessons.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm positive there's a few crashes in my career that would have been non-starters if somebody, before me had either written that down and put it into a company like document somewhere and or, you know, just told me about it. So a good example of at Hadrian, what we do is we do these things called build reviews. So every build, every job has a document associated with it. It denotes the successes of the job. It denotes the failures of the job. And then it also denotes improvement areas. And then those are all distilled into different categories. And then they're kind of sparsed out throughout different domains within the company and then used as a way to improve our system overall. So every job we actually look at as an input to making the factory system better. And we always come away with action items. Even for the most successful builds, there's always something you could have done better. And then those get, you know, kind of assigned and then, you know, remedied for the next build. So the goal is just to continually get better.
Have you found any way to make like postmortems like that quick and easy and actually useful? Because I know I've worked in companies where you start saying, oh yeah, we're going to do postmortems every job. And then they just become a hassle and they end up taking up more time than anybody would like. And I think we all are kind of looking for that magic bullet of like, here's a quick postmortem that accurately describes the situation, but also doesn't, like, nobody feels like it's a waste.
Yeah, so the postmortems are not really done in post. So part of the requirement of like programming and making a component is to fill that out as you go. So one, it doesn't have to be the most articulated, well thought through like sentence. You can just quickly write down the problem at hand. And then in post, myself or my boss will go in and kind of put this in words that might be easier to digest for, let's say, a software engineer. And then we don't put the onus just on the programmer. We put the onus on the team to do this. So it really becomes more of like a crowdsourcing effort than like this individual has to write like an entire document on everything that went wrong, which then can feel very burdensome, I guess is the right word. There is probably not a magic bullet, but I will say like sharing that load across many people and then also making that experience not a finger waving session, but like an exploratory session of how we can all get better together really has made them quite successful here so far. And then we also don't always do them in a sit down setting. So for instance, if there's only a couple prove outs on a part and it goes right into production, we might not have a conversation that follows. The document might just be the document and people read that async. But after the fact, if there's a one that there's a lot of learning potential from, or a job that we might have, you know, 3-5 prove outs before hitting production, we'll have a sit down, and we sit down all from the CEO, all the directorship, all the head ofs, all the ICs involved, and we all just have a real frank conversation about what we can get better at. And that actually has been very therapeutic for the team, and then, you know, also been quite successful for like expediting ramping our floor operations.
Awesome. Well, yeah. To jump back into team building, let's go down the route of first, what do you look for in team members that you're bringing on? Like when you're interviewing people, what are traits or answers to questions that you find most compelling and easiest to like hire immediately?
High integrity, character. That's the first thing that I really pinpoint when I'm hiring someone, regardless of like skill set or, you know, experience level. I find that the most skilled people in industry might not always be the easiest people to actually build a team around. Not saying that you wouldn't want those people on your team, but like I do not want brilliant jerks on my team. If you're a brilliant individual that has a great character and high integrity, we can work with you all day and please apply. But I find that, as they say, like one bad apple, you know, can ruin a culture. I actually have seen that firsthand. So we try to hire for integrity and character, and that's something that I really have a passion for.
What questions do you ask potential employees to try to pull that out of them?
Usually if I don't have a good clue already, or if there's not anyone that like potentially knows that person in the industry, because usually I vet people pretty hard. I mean, classically, I think I've had interviews that have went on for 3 or 4 months before hiring someone, because I just didn't have a real good indication of whether or not the person was going to be an asshole. But one of the things I like to lead with is just like, tell me something you fucked up. And then also tell me how it affected other people around you. And usually what I'm trying to get out of them is, one, I want them to relax. Usually when somebody throws an F-bomb in an interview, people sometimes kind of relax a little bit, let the gloves off, aren't as guarded, so they speak more frankly. I do know I have been in very, very rigid interviews where that wasn't accepted practice at the company. And those ones always feel a lot harder to get that information. But yeah, I just really, if somebody can openly discuss something that they've made a mistake on, and then also can articulate how a decision that they came to and how that affected people around them, and they can get really deep into that, that shows a lot of emotional intelligence. And generally emotional intelligence is usually a good indicator of, you know, future successful employee. So.
All right. Well, what about the opposite side of that question? What are red flags that show up in an interview? Things that you wouldn't want on your team? Maybe something that isn't an obvious red flag. I mean, we all have interviewed or been in interviews with assholes that are very obvious. And you're like, you know, this is the last I want to see of you. Thank you. But what about people who kind of get past that, those first couple of questions? What red flags them?
Using the word I more than we, I think. Most people know that really successful teams or companies generally take an outlook of shared responsibility. And So if I get the indication that somebody is more self-centered by using the word I as a good one. The other one is like coded blame. Like usually it comes off as like a sarcastic comment or maybe even like a light joke about like, you know, I've heard this a million times. You know, and turns out like, you know, the stock prep wasn't that good. If our technician, you know, would have just turned that darn blade down a little bit or, you know, sped up the feed here, then the part would have started in a better spot and then thus the end result would have been better. Like technically that might have been correct, but like there was like that statement has a direct pointed blame on one individual and likely there's not just one smoking gun to a problem in a process. So I would have rather heard something like, you know, turns out that we were sawing, you know, stock that wasn't really very perpendicular. So we were actually gripping the part in a vise and the stock was kicked a little bit. So what I did was I went and I talked to the technician about next time how to remedy that problem. So you fix it for everyone that's going to be involved with somebody that's working with this person in the future. And then two, you make it a shared responsibility. Like now that is also my problem to help fix. And it's not pointed directly on this one human being, right, to fix it. So.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I don't know if you've read the book Extreme Ownership, but
I don't think I have actually, or maybe I have, but I don't recall.
It's by Jocko Willink, the ex Navy SEAL. And yep. The whole book is about just taking absolute extreme ownership for everything. You know, that like instead of saying, oh, the saw guy screwed that up, it's, oh, I forgot to measure it, you know. And very often, even if you know deep down you're not the one at fault, like by taking extreme ownership, it encourages other people to, you know, come up and say, oh, no, I saw it wrong. I did it wrong. I won't do that again. I'm learning from this.
I always love talking to you, Dylan, because I always come away with a new book to read. So I'm writing that down right now. Thank you. Awesome.
We read it as a company culture shift at my last job. And I thought it was very, very important. You know, it might not be everybody's cup of tea in terms of the stories he tells and the way he tells them. But I think that the core value of that book is immeasurable.
All right. Well, it's on my reading list, so I will have to call you and discuss it later once I get through it. So
definitely. Well, so I brought up company culture. Yeah. Let's talk about that as well. Like you are now building a company culture from the ground up. How are you tailoring it to what you want and how do you adjust it when you see things that you don't like?
Well, one, I'll say it's refreshing. This is the second time that I've got to kind of build a culture from the ground up, I'd say, but this is the first time where there was really just a few baseline cultural elements in place by the time I had came into Hadrian. I will say like the challenge of building a company culture is like just that, like when there's nothing to start from, that can be quite daunting, but it's quite a bit easier than unwinding what a toxic culture could be or what you think a toxic culture is and then trying to start over from that point, which I've also done. I say the biggest challenge is one, defining what you believe in, right? Like, so what is your guiding principle? What are you driving toward? Luckily for us, we have a very, very mission-based culture. So like what we're developing is a means to an end, right? And what our culture actually needs in order to be successful is to bring a lot of people into industry that are not typical, right? That come from different backgrounds. And that is a value of mine. So I've actually found it very, very easy to kind of embrace what we're doing here and then make it my own and then kind of drive that forward. One of the things I really, really do frown upon is probably the only thing that I would actually fire anyone like at face value for is like knowingly withholding information that could have helped someone. So classic problem in the manufacturing industry is people believe that creates a like your job is safe if you're the only one that knows how to do a thing, right? So like old school machinist doesn't help new machinists, because they're afraid that if they get good at what they do, then they're less valuable, right? So the thing right now that we're doing is overly emphasizing some of our more experienced folks to share their knowledge, and then overly celebrating that, because that really is how we're going to ramp the line cook into becoming a good machinist really quickly. And then two, that I know has an experience in the industry where, you know, machinists wouldn't talk to them for X amount of years because they were the new guy. And we just don't want that culture where people don't feel welcome here. And the best way to feel welcomed is somebody to show active interest in your success. So every day we go out of our way to make sure that one of our senior guys is directly involved with the ramp of one of our newer technicians. And it's quite refreshing.
That's great. And then in the past, I mean, it sounds like at Hadrian, you don't have to correct things that much. It's more about starting from the ground up. But at past jobs, what tips and tricks do you have for correcting when people step out of company culture? Because I know that that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. And sometimes, to be fair, at times it's actually, bit me. But I think one of the things that I think I respect, and I think most people on earth respect, is living who you are every day at work. So like exuding the culture that you want to see, regardless if you're in a culture that aligns with that. So sometimes leading by example is the best way, or is the only way that you might have the ability to get respite from that situation. The other one is collecting data and then showing that your cultural way of doing something is more effective than the current status quo. So whatever that may be, if you're leading a small team in the lathe department and you are, for instance, running post-mortem meetings to learn from one another, and you're encouraging people to talk about their failures, and perhaps the milling department's not doing that, there should be a direct correlation of one team doing better than the other. And then if it just so happens that the way you're running that department or the way your group of peers are handling situations are more effective, that usually shows up in the bottom line for a company. And then you should articulate it. This is what we've been doing differently, and this is why we believe that we're doing better. Usually tying things to that company's bottom line is usually the best way to have a cultural momentum shift.
Definitely. So that's unfortunate, but definitely
super unfortunate. Yeah, because it usually seems very night and day. Unfortunately, it's like being too close to a problem, right? When you're too close to a problem for a very long time, sometimes it's very hard to realize that there's a different way. So usually the kick in the rear end is your bottom line. So if you see a department that's actually outperforming historical norms, and a group of people are telling you why they believe they are doing that, usually a business owner will start listening.
Definitely, yeah. So Kintz Precision asked, in regards to training purposes, what groups of people have you found to be the most successful when training? Tech school graduates, self-taught? I mean, clearly you're hiring people from completely different industries. So what do you find the best so far? I mean, it seems like you guys have built a fairly good sized team and are continuing to.
So we have a mixture of, newer to career programmers on my team to, industry experts. The industry experts, the hardest part to train, the hardest part for them to get over is the hurdle of associating what I was talking about earlier, associating their learnings and failures openly, right? And then not just powering through a problem because they have the ability to solve them, but making sure that the newer programmer has that information that so when they encounter a similar problem set, they can overcome it. So that's been the hardest part. But I would say, like, historically, I've generally worked with a lot of people that are coming into the trade that are fresh, self-taught. And I find that those are the folks that, for me, have been the easiest to train, mostly because they don't have any like cultural or industry bad habits to unwind. They're coming in fresh. They just want to learn. and they don't come with all of the things to unravel. So that for me, it's been like the non-traditional route has usually been more successful for my training style. But that being said, like I welcome everyone, anyone that has a rigorous mindset, very detailed oriented, you know, wants to learn, I welcome them, you know, as long as like they leave some of that historical, historical bad behavior is probably not the right word, but kind of if they share the mindset, if their experience that they want to change the way this industry is ran, I don't care about your background at that point. It's just like culture though. Sometimes it's easier to start fresh than to unwind some of that bad behavior or maybe some of the things that they've learned over time that now are just part of their norm.
So how are you attracting those people? That. Like, how do you attract people from outside of machining? Because it doesn't seem like, you know, if I went to somebody who works in a restaurant, they might A, not even know what machining is, and B, I don't think they would care about, you know, whatever my mission statement is. They'd be like, yeah, cool, whatever. That has nothing to do with me.
Well, one of the things that I do is if I meet somebody, well, sometimes it's just if I just meet them by happenstance and then we get talking about maybe what we do for a living, I like to associate what I do with what they do. A good one for a line cook is line cooks are very process oriented. So there's like a very strategic and very set way something has to happen. Otherwise, if you're in the middle of that line, for instance, and you start getting backed up, you are now affecting everyone around you. So the people before you are starting to stack up and they're running out of room to complete their task. And then the people after you are now waiting on you to get done to pass on to the next step. So really I look at like people that work in kitchens is a great example of like they're manufacturing engineers. They just don't know it. And they're very process oriented. So once I'm able to relate what they're doing daily to what I do, usually they're hooked, right? Because then you get to throw some technology in. Then I start to speak more to like the CAM portion, what I believe CNC programming is and what it will become one day. And that usually piques their interest enough to get them into the facility. And at that time, you know, the trade generally pays a little bit better than that industry. So then we can help, you know, with the we can help financially and then, you know, then give them an outlook of what it looks like to be successful in the industry and then hopefully get them to join.
And what about balancing training with automation? Because they could seem from the outside like they're at opposition to each other. You're trying to automate so much that somebody doesn't need to be trained. But then when things kind of fall apart, you need somebody who knows what they're doing to be able to fix that and diagnose it. So how are you balancing that?
That's a great question, actually. Probably the hardest thing to articulate to someone is that automation, especially in like the 0 to 1 category, is actually meant to like supercharge the programmer. It's not meant to take their job away. I think I mentioned this to you, Dylan, like 50% of the time when I open a CAM session, I do the same exact thing, right? So I set up a job list is what I call it, but a top level of my program, it usually points to a fixturing model, usually points to a part model I intend to manufacture, usually has some type of coordinate system or origin location. Then I usually step over and set up my layer structure so I can organize my file so then I can reference it later and understand where my things are. And then at that point, I can then start putting toolpath on the part. Usually when I do that, usually it is a similar thing, right? I do roughing first, then I do some rust roughing, then I go and probably do some semi-finishing, then I might do some deburring, then I might do holes, and then I might do final finishing, right? That is pretty much every part I've ever made in a nutshell, like right there. Right. So basically automation is to get you past some of the minutiae that I just spoke through and let you focus on like the 20% of the part that makes it really hard for a manufacturer to make, like a 5-axis undercut, like relief that has a special form for some valve that has to sit on the bottom of a thread seat. Like that can be very difficult and sometimes take hours to get your like perfect tool path. I'd rather have you start from that point to get that nice seat, that thing that we're worried that we won't make money at the company because it's going to be hard to manufacture, and then get you all the way up to it right away versus you spending a day getting to that point. So that's really how I explain automation at Hadrian is we're just trying to get your experience and your mind focused on the problems that make this thing hard and let you forget about some of the other things that you're going to just do every time, right?
What about training operators? Because there's, I think that that line of how much do you want your operator to know and how, where do you start teaching them? I mean, if you start automating tool choice and it's all preloaded in the machine for the most part, like that's when, like, do you want your operators to know kind of why you're choosing tools and kind of why you're choosing tool holders? And like, where is that line of this is the information you need to know and this is the information I'd like you to know eventually?
That's a great question. I think that is very individual specific, in my opinion. I think if somebody has the want to understand and they ask the questions, I'll spend an entire day like informing them exactly why we are removing metal in this way versus a different way. If they ask me about tooling, I'll go as deep as they would like to go until they either I start to see them glaze over. Sometimes that happens, or if they're really excited to go deeper, I'll give them like a book on tool holders, or my favorite book to give people that are really interested in like especially initial like manufacturing process is Sandvik's like Cutting Edge book. Have you ever read that book? Yeah, it's
great.
It's incredibly dry. You have to be the right person to read it, but it's my favorite book to point at an operator that's really, really curious. Because if they come back to me in a month with a question like on page like 283, like I know that this person probably is like on the way to like really going deep into the trade. But yeah, I think it's a fine line. Like you don't want to be overbearing initially on an operator, especially if they don't want to know certain things, but you want to encourage people to ask questions and you never want to be withdrawn from that. So I wouldn't say that there is a cut and dry like cutoff there.
So Level Up CNC asked, for shops starting out with 3+2, what are some tips on making the transition and also training his operators? So what would you say are like the base level of knowledge or things that you would definitely instill in every operator going into 5-axis or 3+2?
It's process engineering. It's like understanding what you're going to do like on a normal op. So you have a vise bolted to a table. And then what would be your next step if you're, for instance, going to put that vise onto a tombstone to do a side port, let's say? What are you going to do last, right? So like what's your last face out of 6 sides? What are you going to do last and why? Like just having that understanding of like when to remove metal and why you're doing it and being able to articulate kind of that entire flow is actually way more important than understanding like how to like run or operate that same part in a 5-axis machine. Cause actually all you do is you take away the manual manipulation of a part. Like it's very hard to debug problems on a 5-axis machine, but from like basic programming and like basic like manufacturing engineering or like applications, like a 3-axis part takes a lot more skill than a 5-axis part, in my opinion. So I think if you've mastered 3-axis and you're ready to make the jump to 5-axis, I actually think the barrier of entry is actually like just learning fixturing and like those newer work holding methods that like you might have not used on a 3-axis machine. Like dovetail fixturing, for instance, is kind of scary for some people. Getting over that hurdle is probably a bigger hurdle than the actual like the 5-axis machine itself.
All right. Do you have any good resources that you've turned to explain 5-axis work holding and fixturing and things like that?
I don't actually, but I would love to know if anyone else, you know, out there does. Yeah, actually don't. I think that there's a lot of websites that do a pretty good job of explaining like five-axis work holding and why it exists, like self-centering versus like, you know, a static jaw. But I don't have a lot of like books to point people at. So if you guys have anything, I'd love to hear.
Definitely. Reach out, guys. Do you guys at Hadrian have like a compendium of knowledge? Like, are you guys adding, you know, books like Sanvix and things like that to a place that people can go to look up anything?
Yeah, so we're internally developing like our own like wiki, right? Which is just like as new and cool things that people are learning on the team, they come across, they'll add it to our internal CAM team wiki page. I'm constantly sharing books. Like I just shared a book with one of our programmers, which is Compliant Mechanisms, which is like one of my favorite books ever because they were learning how to create flexured fixturing techniques. So basically you wanted to make a flexure to actually like pinch a corner by using a set screw. And it was a really cool method, but didn't really understand how to calculate how much force he needed to put on this face and what that equated to on the corner of his part. So like I gave him this book and he's been learning and that picture actually turned out quite good. I actually got that book from Mr. Phil Nestenhauser as well years ago and found it very, very interesting. So I do that. We'll pass around books internally. One of my direct reports gave me a book called Clean Code, which is also, he gave it to me because the way I explain a program to someone that has never seen a program is I basically explain it as a story. Like a really good programmer should be able to tell a story with their CAM session, right? Like, you know, so like you should be able to look at the high level of the program and understand each chapter of the book and have a vague understanding of what that's doing. So like, in HyperMill, they're called compounds. Basically, a compound is just a folder that has all the detail, which is the CAM cycle, inside of it. So like roughing would be a great, you know, title to a chapter. And then all the roughing toolpath would be the details of that actual chapter. So apparently this book had, I had said something to him, he passed this book on to me and, has like a few snippets in there that sounded very much how I describe what a good programmer is able to do with their CAM session. And then now I'm learning, you know, really good like foundational practices to becoming a really good computer programmer, which is one of my personal goals to eventually have a computer science degree. Who knows when, sometime down the road, but.
That's very cool. Yeah. G-code is very interesting in code in general. My wife's a teacher and she does this class lesson where she has her kids write a step-by-step instruction on how to build a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and teaches them how to be incredibly explicit. So like if they say, now open the jelly and spread it on the thing, she opens the jar of jelly and spreads the entire jar on the bread. And they go, well, what are you doing? And she said, well, you didn't say to use a knife. You didn't say to put it in the jar, you know, things like that. And so, yeah, it's learning how to be incredibly explicit with all of your instructions because the machines are dumb. They will do exactly what you tell them to do, even if it's really stupid.
That's exactly right. That's actually, that feels like a great way of teaching someone how to articulate a manufacturing process.
Oh yeah.
Have them spell out how to create a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I actually just wrote that down because I feel like that has a port over somewhere in the factory. I know it sounds funny, but that actually is a great way of doing that. So I'm taking that one. I'm gonna put that one in my back pocket.
I'll let her know. I'm sure she'll be very happy. It's
applicable. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. All right.
Well, I usually do what's new, but I think this might be a good time to talk about the culture of machining in general. Bree Pettis asked about your insight into a pattern or pathway to building a stronger culture of machining or manufacturing in our culture in general. And I think that that's both of our goals and something I'd love to talk about more is, you know, how do we fix this this idea that machining is dark and dreary and ugly and not the fun trade that it is?
Well, I think it takes, you know, what you're doing here, which is, you know, bringing people on and talking about what they love. I think it takes, there's the old adage that people are afraid of stuff. People generally are only afraid of things they don't know. So that goes with like cultures that they don't understand. People become afraid of those. So I think one, it starts with just a campaign of like understanding, right? Like, what is manufacturing today? I think that everyone has this like thought that the industry is like what my dad was in. Like, he used to come home filthy every day, oil all over him, just always really messy. And like, today's manufacturing workforce, they do not go home looking like that day in and day out. That's not all of them. I should say, like, there's still people running oil, you know, screw machines that are doing great work, that require a little bit more of that, you know, hands-on kind of work. But I would say like, it just really just comes with like education, like at a high level. Also, I don't think that we're doing a very good job as a country explaining what manufacturing looks like today. I think I've mentioned this to you, Dylan. I truly believe in 10 years, 20 years, machinists will not be employable unless they have at least an understanding of like basic coding knowledge, I guess the basic understanding of how to read like a code base. I think one day you'll see a lot of machinists include on their resume that I know how to Python code, or one of their major accomplishments in their career will be, I automated a workflow for file transfer to the machinery, right? Stuff like that. That's a thing that's really overlooked. It was mostly thrown into the manufacturing engineering bucket or applications engineering bucket, but I actually think that that's becoming more and more of what a CAM programmer and a machinist will need, more and more light blue collar to white collar even one day. Although there will always be the hands-on element in the trade, I think what people don't understand right now is that our industry is going through very much an inflection point where it's changing rapidly, and it has to change in order to keep up with other countries that have much more labor. So hence why Hadrian is doing what we're doing. We are a big country that needs to automate in order to keep up with lower wage countries. And we're probably the best position to do that, considering, you know, Silicon Valley and some of the traditional powerhouses in the technology field are located here. Feels like it just needs to transfer over to our industry now. So,
yeah, definitely. Well, and, you know, you're a daddy junkie as well. And like, with all of this data, you need some way to parse it and make it usable. And like, that's where the coding comes in. And like, yeah, you can hope and pray that the company you work at has somebody that can do that for you, or you can learn to code and figure it out yourself.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And I'm not like, I will say firsthand, I'm not the best at this, but it's something that I've actively tried to get better at over the last few years. And it really has made me a better programmer. I think I have become more analytical with like post structure and things that I probably took for granted in the past, but actually have realized like the readability of my code is just as important as maybe the output of it. So like, that's also a very good indication if you have a good post, right, that has really good comments in it that, you know, your operator can follow along, also then may be able to find a problem with your program if you're consistent. So like, having a consistent output every time that tells a story eventually leads to natural learning from operators on the floor. So yeah, I think it's something like you were mentioning, I think the last time I talked to you, that you're taking some Python classes. How have you got anything out of it? Like, how does that relate directly to your day-to-day?
So far day-to-day it hasn't translated, but I think learning any code at this stage is very important. Like I I've done a little bit of post modifications. I now pay somebody to do further ones that I can't do yet. But I think just being able to go into the code, you know, Python and HTML are not the same code, but their structures are not too dissimilar. And I can go in there and I can at least sort of understand, you know, declaring variables and using them and things like that. And I think the more I learn and the more I understand about that, the better, for sure.
Love it. It's awesome.
Well, that brings me to the last question I ask every guest every week, which is, what did you research this week? And it doesn't have to be machining. It can be anything under the sun, but just what's been popping up in your browser.
I have been researching a new car. I'm thinking, I have a really hellacious commute. If anyone lives in LA or understands the 405, it is the bane of my existence. So it also creates a situation where the car that I have now, which is a Lexus ES350, which I love, is starting to become very difficult to like keep money in my pocket because I'm burning gas. Now that gas is at like $6 a gallon here in LA, I'm burning a lot of gas. So right now I'm actively doing an ROI, whether or not I can afford to buy a Polestar, particularly the Polestar 2, which I think is a really, really cool design. I'm also looking up right now some things that how much can I say without giving it away? My wife might listen to this. I'm looking at, my wife's about to graduate soon, so I'm actually looking for a cool gift for her. And I won't go into that much further, but that's the other part of that's recently in my browser history. I'd like to ask you the same question. I'm curious, what have you been looking up recently?
Well, I just got a new 3D printer, so I have been diving deep into, thankfully not having to do too much research. It is, the whole reason I bought it is that I wanted something that was not a project. I know a lot of listeners reached out when I posted it on Instagram and said, well, what happened to the Voron build? What are you doing with that? You know, did you not stop that? And it's like, no, I didn't stop it, but I wanted something that I could just plug in and start printing. And like, it's basically been running, except for the time I'm recording this, nonstop for the last like 36 hours. So that's kind of what I wanted. And, you know, I'm super happy with it. And it's just crazy fast. I mean, I think it's, I've had so many people reach out looking at the videos and they say, wait, is that sped up or is that normal speed? And it's like, no, that's normal speed. It is what it is. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's been fun. We use it a bunch in the shop for, you know, call it storage and bespoke storage solutions for us. And then I've also looked, there's a few people on Instagram, Alton Engineering being one, that prints packaging for their parts when they're shipping them to customers so they don't get damaged. They're shipping them to anodize. And I think that, you know, I don't think every part I make really affords itself that, but I've definitely made some parts where it's like, man, I really like, I bubble wrapped this to the nth degree, but I really wish there was something else in there. So yeah, that's going to be great for that.
Awesome.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. It's been great to get to pick your brain about, you know, teams and the industry problems we have and the way we're going to solve them.
Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. I look forward to continuing this relationship and then, you know, hopefully our passion for training and kind of growing this industry can continue, through these chats.
Definitely. And thanks to all the Patreon members. Thanks to Johan and Nicholas. And thanks everyone for listening. I'll be back next week.